Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present the voices of some of the hundreds of thousands who protested against the Bush agenda the day before the Republican National Convention opened in New York City. Chris Rangro, co-founder of the Imagine Festival of Arts, Issues and Ideas, who explains the theme and purpose of some 200 performances and exhibits scheduled in New York City during the Republican National Convention. And journalist and filmmaker Danny Schechter, who assesses the media's coverage of the Republican convention and the protesters who greeted them. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Guardian newspaper reports that newly declassified documents show that Henry Kissinger, as Secretary of State in the Ford administration, gave a green light to the generals who took power in Argentina to suppress the growing left-wing opposition in 1976. According to a paper released by the National Security Archive in Washington, D.C., Kissinger told Admiral Cesar Augusto Gazzetti, then Argentina's foreign minister, that the quicker things get done, the better. A secret operation was launched by the Argentine junta in 1976, led by President Jorge Videla, called the Condor Plan, with other dictatorships in Chile, Paraguay, Bolivia, Uruguay, and Brazil to crush leftist movements in the name of fighting terrorism. Officials say at least 9,000 people were killed or disappeared in Argentina in the late 70s, with some human rights organizations estimating the number to be as many as 30,000. William Rogers, a former State Department official and now vice chairman of Kissinger Associates, dismissed the declassified documents as preposterous, claiming that Kissinger would never, under any circumstances, tell another government to violate human rights either quickly or slowly. However, another State Department official, Patricia Darien, who visited Buenos Aires in 1977, said that Kissinger has people talking for him, claiming he is misunderstood. The result, she says, is he has only been embarrassed and thus far has not been held accountable for his actions. In the wake of the 9/11 terrorist attack, safety and the vulnerability of nuclear power plants gained new public attention. But the concern had virtually no impact on the Bush Nuclear Regulatory Commission. According to the Progressive magazine, the NRC has proposed relaxing fire safety standards that currently call for automatic shutdowns at nuclear power stations. Instead, the new policy calls for relying more on operators to run through the plant manually, shutting off systems by hand that may already be in flames. In March, two leading Democrats, Congressman Ed Markey of Massachusetts and John Dingell of Michigan, called the NRC plan potentially catastrophic. Industry critics point out that fire poses a real threat to nuclear stations. In 1975, workers at the Browns Ferry plant in Alabama accidentally started a fire in the insulating material around cables. The fire lasted 7 hours and damaged cables that regulated the temperature in the reactor core. For 22 years, Jerry Brown worked as a consultant on fire and radiation issues for nuclear plants. Brown, who retired in 1998, is appalled at the proposed NRC fire standards. He stated that to have a runaway nuclear reactor with no ability to shut it down would be criminal. It could kill a million people, he said. He further observed that there are more fire barriers in a nursing home than in a nuclear power plant. The 2000 Florida voter purge of former felons put a public face on the difficulty of restoring voting rights for ex-cons. In 2004, prison reform groups are mounting an aggressive voter registration drive in swing states to tap the potential of an estimated 9 million former felons. In many states, the laws on voting rights are confusing. In New York State, parolees can't vote, while those on probation can. However, many state election officials have refused to allow ex-felons to vote. According to the news magazine In These Times, a Montana prison reform group called Connections sent a survey to county election officials and selected probation officers in the state asking if ex-felons were eligible to vote. A majority of the officials gave the wrong answer, that ex-cons could not vote, ignoring a 34-year-old law giving voting rights to former felons. It comes as no surprise, then, that most ex-felons have no idea that they have the right to vote. The Western Prison Project is working to change that with a targeted voter registration campaign in Oregon, Montana, Utah, and Nevada. They are seeking out new voters in halfway houses and other places frequented by ex-cons. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Zelfia Hunter.
In what's being called the largest protest at a political convention in U.S. history, an estimated 500,000 opponents of President Bush took to the streets of Midtown Manhattan on Sunday, August 29th, the day before the start of the Republican National Convention in New York City. Between the Lines, Scott Harris was there and files this report.
In the days before the Republicans opened their convention in New York City, thousands of activists from across the country came to voice their opposition to numerous Bush administration policies. They came to protest the Iraq War, tax cuts for the wealthy, environmental deregulation, attacks on reproductive rights, organized labor, and civil liberties. Participating in literally hundreds of demonstrations, public forums, and teach-ins coinciding with the convention were blue-collar workers, professionals, students, and housewives. Actions organized included massive bike rides, union pickets, permitted and unpermitted demonstrations, and nonviolent civil disobedience. By the end of the second day of the convention, police had arrested some 700 protesters for mostly minor infractions. The largest demonstration took place on Sunday, August 29th, when an estimated 500,000 people filled 40 city blocks for nearly 6 hours in a march past Madison Square Garden, the site of the GOP convention. Although the city of New York and state Supreme Court denied organizers the use of Central Park for a rally, the march was deemed an enormous success by both participants and police. Among those who spoke at a pre-march press conference were Leslie Kagan, national coordinator of United for Peace and Justice, the group which organized Sunday's protest.
Together, we will march past Madison Square Garden, and in a resounding clear voice, we will say no to the Bush agenda. We call for the immediate end of the U.S. occupation in Iraq. We want the troops brought home now. Not tomorrow, not the next day, now.
Fernando Suarez del Solar lost his son, a Marine Lance Corporal, in the Iraq War.
I lost my son. My grandson lost his father. And this one is only one story. Mr. Bush Destroyer murdered 972 families here in home and thousands of thousands in Iraq. The people today have the right for say, Bush, get out of the White House. Thank you.
Kelly Dougherty is an Iraq War veteran.
My name is Kelly Dougherty. I served as a military police sergeant in Iraq with the National Guard unit from February 2003 till 2004. I saw firsthand how this war is serving to dehumanize the Iraqi people, who are destitute and desperate, and they're treated as trespassers in their own country and as criminals by virtue of their citizenship. And this is also dehumanizing the United States troops, who are having their sense of patriotism and loyalty perverted and used by an administration that would send our women and men to fight, die, and kill for lies.
Terry Rockefeller lost her sister in the World Trade Center attack in New York City on September 11th.
When George Bush used the first anniversary of September 11th to call for his immoral and illegal war in Iraq, I was appalled. 3 years later, the results of that war are more disastrous than I ever, ever imagined. 20,000 civilians have died in Afghanistan and Iraq, and their families are now grieving just as mine still grieves. The war in Iraq has fanned the flames of terrorism around the world. It's left us less safe. It's made the world a less safe place.
Author and filmmaker Michael Moore, whose documentary Fahrenheit 9/11 electrified audiences across the nation, has become an important new figure in American politics.
Just to borrow an idea from Congressman Rangel, I really think we need to bring back the draft, but only for the sons of politicians and the sons of executives of Fortune 500 companies. I think if they had to go first, we'd find ourselves in a lot less of these situations.
Those marching in the streets beat drums, chanted, danced, and performed street theater. They displayed every conceivable anti-Bush slogan on T-shirts, papier-mâché puppets, and on colorful and sometimes irreverent signs. Veterans of both the Vietnam War and from the current war in Iraq marched against the Bush administration under the hot August sun. Rob Serra from Chicago is a Marine Corps veteran who served in Iraq during the U.S. invasion in 2003.
We're doing the wrong thing right now. We were lied to going in, basically. They told us there were weapons of mass destruction. There weren't. They told us that Iraq was an imminent threat to the United States. It wasn't. We were in Baghdad in 3 weeks. And now we're bogged down. Guys are dying every day. For nothing. President Bush sent us there. I'm not voting for him.
Vanya of New York City, originally from Haiti, was hopeful that popular opposition to President Bush would overcome the money advantage his supporters have.
I'm here because I can stand Bush. He must go. We didn't put him there. He was not elected by the people. He's not for the people. He's for the rich. I'm not rich.
What do you hope will come out of today?
I hope wake people up. Wake them up. Come and do something. We have the power. We have the power. We're not using it.
Michael Kuzma, an attorney from Buffalo, New York, believes that the re-election of George Bush would present a danger to the nation and the world.
I was in Washington when Bush was sworn in. I knew he was going to be bad for the country. I didn't realize things would be this bad. I think the Bush family is the most dangerous organized crime family on the face of this planet. George Bush is a very serious threat to world peace, and that's why I'm here today.
Tom Hayden, a leader of Students for a Democratic Society and an anti-Vietnam War organizer, accused of conspiracy during the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago, made these observations after Sunday's massive protest.
It appeared that the demonstration exceeded the estimates by which it would be judged a success or failure, so I'm very glad of that. I don't know if there were 100,000 or 500,000 people here, but clearly the biggest demonstration in history at a political convention. But the election is very important because the re-election of Bush would really deepen our isolation in the world and convince people that there's not much difference between the American people and the American government.
As the presidential election approaches, many of the demonstrators in the streets of New York say they will go home energized by the weekend's protest and work hard to defeat President Bush in November. For Between the Lines in New York City, I'm Scott Harris.
This is what America feels like. This is what America feels like. This is what America feels like. This is what
The days preceding and during the Republican National Convention in New York City were filled with protests of all kinds, massive bike rides, nonviolent civil disobedience, and a massive legal march of hundreds of thousands. But cultural events with a political twist have also been part of the convention scene. The Imagine Festival of Arts, Issues, and Ideas hosted more than 200 events, including concerts, film screenings, forums, theater, poetry, and more, focusing on the many critical issues facing the nation and the world this election year. The festival, which featured artists such as comedian Margaret Cho, actor Richard Gere, playwright Tony Kushner, Yoko Ono, and musician Lou Reed, promoted themes of freedom, community, democracy, justice, prosperity, and future. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Chris Wangro, co-founder and co-executive producer of the festival, before a kickoff celebration at a nightclub on August 28th. Wangro is the former director of special events for the New York City Parks Department and an organizer of massive public events, such as the Papal Mass in Central Park. He says this arts festival was meant to engage participants, encourage them to think, and to dialogue with their neighbors.
We decided that the Republican convention was an incredible opportunity for us. We are playing host for a party that we consider the unofficial, uncensored welcome to the RNC, and we're bringing together thousands of artists and activists, all have been working so hard over the past year to make their voices heard in their own way. And what's happening in New York, and we hope what's happening across the country, is an incredible thing, because what's happening is you have the arts community fired up and speaking out, and the activist community fired up and speaking out. The last time this country went through major social change, say 1965 to 1975, it took exactly that. It took artists, filmmakers, writers, fashion designers. It took people who were visionaries to create a different vision for us to understand how we could live differently. It also took tens of thousands of people, if not hundreds of thousands, taking to the streets and marching for civil rights and marching against the war, marching for peace, marching for women's rights. And when both of those things happen, we can change the course of history. And it's happening here, and we're celebrating that. Imagine is now doing, I think, well over 200 events in over 75 venues with really well over 1,000 artists. And it's everything from, you know, household names like Richard Gere or Marisa Tomei or Kathleen Chalfant or Yoko Ono or Philip Glass to really New York's edgiest, most interesting, lesser-known artists. But this is probably, I think it's safe to say, the most important creative community in the country, possibly the world. And when this community gets together and speaks out, we expect America to listen.
These are the people you brought together who have a political perspective that is against Bush,
No, that's not true.
Okay.
We have brought together people on issues. You know, it happens to be that this is a city that is fairly liberal, fairly progressive, and for the most part against Bush. That's no secret. But what we've wanted to do from day one and what we've really been strident about was to bring people together to focus on jobs, on women's health, on education, on the environment, on the you name it. And it's that sort of issue-based agenda that the Imagine Festival has that allows us to build such a big coalition. We have a coalition of people that includes unlikely bedfellows like Republicans for Choice working with, you know, fairly lefty, in quotes, artists, because they're all unified on the importance of women's rights. Now, I will say this. I think, and this is me talking perhaps not for the organization, terms like lefty and righty are just counterproductive. You know, I'm not a lefty. Just because I'm upset that my father has to drive to Mexico to afford his drugs doesn't mean that I'm a lefty. Just because I want to make sure that my sister's kids can actually go to a decent public school and she doesn't have to move to some god-awful town she doesn't want to live in to do that, you know, that doesn't make me a lefty. I am concerned about specific issues, and so many others are as well. And it's the issues that motivate us. And if we can focus on the issues, and we can listen to the visionaries and the educators and all the people who really understand this stuff, we'll get a deeper understanding, and we'll be able to really think out a better course for our future.
I heard Michael Moore's talk. That was about a 45-minute speech he gave at the DNC at some side conference.
Right.
And he was talking about how, you know, we are the majority, the people who are opposed to the policies that are going on now against, you know, women's reproductive rights and the war and the environmental attacks. It's the majority who are against those things. But the reality is that it's going to be a very, very close election. And, I mean, he was saying that a lot of the people who are against those things don't vote. How representative do you think these issues, pro-choice and pro-environment and anti, this particular war at least, are in the country?
I don't know that the artists of New York represent the nation. I do know that we've been contacted, you know, Imagine has been contacted by people in many cities and even overseas who are asking us to assemble similar things. I know that we're inspiring change in the way people face the issues. And I think we need to really rethink how we address the issues and concerns if we really want to make change.
Are you doing that? Are you helping that happen in any other cities?
We have to get through this, and then we'll figure it out. And but there will be more, I'm sure.
Does the name have anything to do with John Lennon? Or you just
Yeah, the name has to do with us deciding that we as citizens and as artists need to help imagine a better future, that we feel the leadership of both parties has let us down, that it's up to us as artists to help imagine a better place. It happened to be that when we came up with this idea, that we knew that John Lennon's song had been struck from the Clear Channel song chart, and we thought that that was a blatant violation of freedom of speech and freedom of expression. So it had a nice tie-in.
That was Chris Wangrow of the Imagine Festival. Visit the group's website at www.imagine04.org. Much as the Democratic Party did in Boston during their convention, Republicans are doing their best to transform and moderate their image for TV cameras focused on the party's first-ever convention in New York City. While President Bush ran for office in 2000 as a compassionate conservative and a uniter, not a divider, his administration has staked out radical right positions on national security, tax policy, civil liberties, and cultural issues like abortion and gay marriage. But during the convention, many of the most influential and powerful controversial figures in the White House and Republican congressional leadership remained out of sight. In their place were Republican moderates such as New York Governor George Pataki, Arizona Senator John McCain, and California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who attempted to convince swing voters in battleground states to support Mr. Bush. In a signal of how politicians will play on the emotions of fearful voters this year, former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani opened the convention by exploiting the memory of the September 11th attacks and the thousands who died to promote President Bush's reelection. It will be largely left to the media to interpret and expose the GOP's extreme makeover seen by millions of Americans viewing the convention through the lens of abbreviated network and cable TV coverage. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with author and filmmaker Danny Schechter of MediaChannel.org, who examines the media's coverage of the Republican convention and the hundreds of thousands of protesters who greeted them in New York City.
400,000 or 500,000 people can march in the streets but could not have a rally, could not have a place to really exchange views and hear ideas that they can resonate with. What was important was, yes, we had the right to speak in the sense that we had a right to have a walk, but we didn't have the right to assemble. And that is one of the protected First Amendment rights, freedom of assembly. And that right was undermined in the city of New York without much protest and complaint by the newspapers. The New York Times, you know, agreed that there should have been a rally in Central Park, but when the city delayed and played games with the protesters, tried to stick them on the West Side Highway so that more people in New Jersey would see them than in New York, and finally the protesters rejected it, the New York Times, you know, basically went tisk tisk, you know, you should live up to your agreements, you know, as if there was something holy about it when it was the city that was denying the freedom of assembly. And many people actually went to Central Park after the march and apparently were able, for the most part, to hang out peacefully and be with each other. Now, the larger point was that the march, usually these things happen, you know, two people throw a stink bomb and the headline is, you know, Violence Mars March, you know. That didn't happen this time. The march was actually treated pretty respectfully and got a front page coverage in a lot of the newspapers I saw. The content of what they were saying about the Bush agenda, the actual issues that brought people into the streets, the war, all of that was sort of lost, I think, in terms of the politics of the march. I think those issues were kind of muted in the coverage, in my opinion.
Danny Schechter, the Republicans are doing everything they can to moderate the image of their party, featuring moderate speakers, Pataki and Arnold Schwarzenegger, etc., and really pushing to the rear of the room all those neocons and others who draw criticism for their extremist views on abortion, women's rights, and so on. Tell us a little bit about how the media treats this kind of spin control.
You know, I think they sort of buy it, you know, for the most part. I mean, the most critical pieces that I saw, really, about all of this was about the party circuit, you know, the big lavish parties with a corporate largesse, you know, paying a lot of money. So there was that kind of you know, expression of sort of media power in the middle of all of this.
What are your concerns when you see big media who have an interest in consolidation and the deregulation issues before Congress? What kind of inherent problems do we have in media covering politics in this country when it comes to those essential issues?
We're talking about the people who run, you know, the media institutions in America, which used to be 50 major companies. Now it's 5 to 7. So you have basically kind of a more of a uniformity of view. Many of these companies, rather than compete with each other, are in bed with each other. They use each other's satellites. They have program deals. They have various ways, strategic alliances in this country or overseas. So they tend to, you know, have a view that's really more along the lines of shut up and shop, you know. We want to sell you things. We don't want you, you know, talking back. We don't want you too active as a citizen. We don't believe in citizenship as much as we do consumership, if that's a word. You know, the challenge that our media, which is there constitutionally protected as an institution to challenge and be a watchdog on abuses of power, has become this kind of lapdog where it often devalues democracy. Less coverage of politics, less debate, less discussion, less airtime for candidates, less coverage of local politics for the most part, fewer in-depth documentaries that explain anything to the public. And so no wonder the voting turnouts keep going down. Why fewer people are involved, you know, because why more people are cynical and don't care. That's the official attitude of much of our media, you know, kind of a contempt, you know, for what's going on. I ran into Dan Rather up in Boston, you know, and, you know, this was at a time when the networks had decided that they weren't going to cover half the convention. And he said, well, we've done our coverage for the day. Now I'm just going to go and listen to the windmill. And that's how, you know, he referred to, you know, all the speechifying, including some major speeches from people that were treated as if they, you know, nobody even went to the rostrum. There was more interest in them putting themselves on TV and commenting on it. What can I say other than, you know, I wish it wasn't this way, but media concentration is responsible for it in large part, as well as the culture of news, the culture of the people running our newsrooms. And that has to be challenged and confronted, not just with slogans, but with alternative and independent media like the kind that you're making, maybe with films of the type I'm trying to make, with radio shows, you know, that offer other points of view. And when people hear that, I think they're interested in it.
That was author and filmmaker Danny Schechter, founder of MediaChannel.org and Global Vision. His latest film, Weapons of Mass Deception, examines the media's coverage of the Iraq War. See a trailer of the documentary at WMDthefilm.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio, and where you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Top. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Sophia Hunter, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.